that stuff. Her is exceedingly subtle. Her is the science fiction of a Heinlein, Kelly Link of James Tiptree Jr. It's real science fiction.
But as far as the optimism at the end that you have there about humans learning to communicate again,
Amy Adams and Joaquin Phoenix sitting together watching
on the edge of a building.
Yeah, that scared that did scare me.
And that letter has all the tones of a suicide note as much as of a communication. So I think it's a very mixed bag.
I freaked at that time. Yeah. I did think that the movie was going to go. Barbara, my partner, she's looking at me going, no, no. But I had exactly the reaction that you had. Yeah. Maybe it's a man thing. I don't know. But yes, I thought that his letter, which was so expressive and so beautiful and all that, it doesn't say anything about suicide. It is the end of a relationship. Okay. He is breaking up with her. And then he goes to the edge of the building, and I'm to the roof of the building, which has no eave upon it. And there is Amy Adams. And I think, are they going to hold hands and jump?
I mean, the question he asks her is, will you go with me? You know, and it's like, wondering, you know, what sort of departure he has in mind.
No, I think that was slightly mishandled, or else Jones was trying.
I think he's trying for a mix.
I think so. And I think that doesn't work. Because when you follow it, and with critics like Tony Scott of the New York Times, A.O. Scott, and Anthony Lane reviewed it in the New Yorker, I've read all the reviews, I can quote them, they all pick up on the optimism of the end and the rediscovery of humanity at the end. But Jones is a bit ambiguous about that and scared me for a while. But the end of the movie ends up with that they're sitting down and they're watching the dawn of a new day and they hold hands.
Yeah. And it's very human presence sort of stuff, that simple.
Yeah. And, you know, as for Kurzweil and other people saying an AI wouldn't do that, it's like, you know what? He could have written it differently. He could have written that the AI broke down. He could have, you know, they don't have to transcend and become something else. But he wanted a happy end for Sam.
Right.
You know, where you can imagine that's going on. And besides, it is science fiction. But our mind is not supposed to go off with Sam. Our mind is supposed to be with Ted. And to discover Ted's discovery of communications, and all of a sudden he's left with Amy Adams. Who played his wife, who he's breaking up with? Wonderful actress.
Oh, yeah. Mara Rooney.
And he has an encounter with Olivia Wilde. I mean, between Olivia Wilde, Mara Rooney,
poor Joaquin Phoenix.
And not to mention Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. And Amy Adams.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's quite a cast.
It really is. And the performances are great. And it did win the Academy Award for Best Screenplay. And deservedly so. And here's my anger.
Okay.
It didn't even get a Hugo nomination.
Yeah, I didn't. Which one?
Like three episodes of Doctor Who.
Oh, well, yeah. That's been going on for years, though, that too many.
Hey, I'm a huge Doctor Who fan.
But maybe just consolidate around one and take up a Doctor Who slot.
I didn't think that the episodes that were nominated were that great, the closing episode and all that. You know, not compared to Stephen Moffat's earlier efforts. No way. I'll tell you what I did love, but it wasn't science fiction was the Five Doctors Revisited. The one produced and directed by Peter Davison.
I saw that on YouTube.
Where Peter Davison and Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker all go, and it turns out that they were in the final episode. They were wearing sheets they're never seen, and how they break their way onto the set because they feel they ought to be in the 50th anniversary episode. We see Peter Davison was the fifth Doctor. His real name is Tennant.
Oh, that's funny.
His daughter is named Georgina. No, not Tennant. Her name is now Georgina.
Did a Tennant because she married
the fifth doctor's daughter married the ninth Doctor.
Which would be an interesting story to do sometime.
But his name isn't Peter Davison. It's, you know, that's a stage name.
Oh.
It is Tennant, I think, but spelled differently.
Okay.
No, of course. His last name is Moffat.
Oh, really?
Moffett, as opposed to the writer and showrunner, who's Moffat.
Yes.
So we now have the Moffats. Mary, you know, and the daughter of one Doctor who in an episode plays David Tennant's daughter. Remember?
I remember reading all about this.
The name of the episode is The Doctor's Daughter. Yeah. And he basically puts his hand into a machine, which then spawns a fully grown daughter of the Doctor with Time Lord capabilities.
Something, I remember that episode.
She's out there. Well, that's her. That's the current Mrs. David Tennant, who happens to be the fifth Doctor's daughter, who played the ninth Doctor's daughter on TV, whose name is Moffat. I mean, come on, give me a freaking break. It was hilarious.
It's a tight community over there in BBC land.
It really is. So Peter Davison made this movie, and as far as I'm concerned, that movie is funnier and better than the actual Doctor Who episodes, including the 50th anniversary episode.
Well, did you see the kind of docudrama about the first Doctor that aired at the same time?
About Verity Lambert.
Yes, I thought that was wonderful.
That was brilliant. I knew the story, and I knew about Verity Lambert, who also worked on The Avengers. She worked on Blake 7. She's responsible for a lot of the best BBC programming through the years. And just to make things, again, and she's played by Jessica, what's her last name, from Call the Midwife, which is a wonderful show.
And a shout-out for Brian Cox makes another appearance.
Yes, that's right.
Going from the voicing Alan Watts that we were talking about.
To playing Sydney, Canadian producer who hires Verity Lambert and brings in, what's his name, Hussein, the original director of Doctor Who, was a gentleman, a Muslim gentleman of Indian descent. People don't realize how multicultural the show was right off the bat, produced by a woman, not common, directed by a Muslim gentleman, et cetera, starring this crusty old William Hartnell, beautifully played by David Bradley, who's probably best known as Filch from all the Harry Potter films. But he also played Cohen, the barbarian, in the Terry Pratchett. I love these little circular things, which was originally green-lighted by Verity Lambert.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you just gotta love all these little circles of stuff. Not to mention that this stuff was being created for a number of years and run by Douglas Adams, who is here in WBAI, which you need to support by calling 212-209-2950. Okay, I've been blathering, and we're 6 minutes into where we should have started.
Oh, it started the... Yes.
Yeah, well, no, I have to pitch, because that's what I was going to do between 1 and 1:30.
Very good.
We do... But I also thought that it was fair to give listeners a break from listening to the phone number. That break is over. We're going to do 5 minutes. We're not going to do that much longer. But let me impress upon you the seriousness. I started working at WBAI. How many of you have heard this story before? I started working at WBAI in 1967. I was a phone volunteer. I was 13 years old. I came to answer the phones for the fundraising drive. I hung out after the drive and met this guy working on a radio drama by the name of Samuel R. Delaney, who is this year's grandmaster of science fiction and probably the first foremost black writer and gay writer, openly gay writer.
In the genre.
I mean, we now know from Cherie Renee Thomas's book, Dark Matter, that there was a lot of good people of color in black science fiction predating Chip. But Delaney, he's known as Chip Delaney. Delaney was really the best known at the time. He was very, very well known when I met him in 1967. The other people, Baird Searles was the drama and literature director. And I interned myself to him, fetching coffee, important jobs. And the people who I met working for Baird were Theodore Sturgeon, Joanna Russ, Thomas M. Dish, Robert Silverberg, Harlan Ellison, blah, 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 blah. Now, actually, Silverberg and Ellison, I met more, I just met them briefly and all that, and I knew them from science fiction conventions, which I had already been going to. But Sturgeon was doing radio drama here at WBAI. Delaney created the Star Pit. Nebula Award-winning story, The Star Pit, for WBAI.
And when do you air that every year? You air that once a year, don't you?
I can't air it once a year because I currently only have a 90-minute show. And it's a two-hour broadcast.
But I try
to get time for it. I will tell people you can get it from the Pacifica Archives. You can go to, just Google up Pacifica Archives and go there and then search for the Star Pit. And you will get it. You can also get interviews with Philip K. Dick that were done by Mike Hodel, who was on Hour of the Wolf, and Margot Adler was host of Hour of the Wolf. Then he went to our sister station in L.A., and he started a science fiction program there called Hour 25. Which is an excellent, excellent show. And then Hodel died at a horribly young age. He was about 42, 43. Oh. I mean, horrible. I mean, I hate mortality, period. And I'm staring at a picture of Robert Knight and being like, come on. This is not fair. This is not right. Robert is about my, 2 years older than me.
Well, it's hard to believe that Chip Delaney wasn't already a grandmaster,
Well, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although, I mean, there are no names in that list that aren't worthy.
Yeah.
But it was just sort of like, should have happened earlier, because Chip is now about 75.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. He was born in 1940.
Okay.
So, April 1st, 1940. Easy, 4140. It's easy to remember his birthday. So that makes him 74. Should have happened before now. And by the way, Chip, I'm coming for you. You're either going to do a radio show or a Near Sif reading or something. You're on notice. Anyway, and he's such a sweet person. He always does everything he can for WBAI and so forth. And the point is, what other radio station could we even talk about where something like this could occur? Well, the answer is KPFA, because Mike Hodel, who Margot Adler created Hour of the Wolf Monday through Friday, I was with her Thursdays and Fridays, and every so often, not all the time, every so often, Mike Hodel would come on. He was a news director. He became news director in L.A. Margot was a news director here at BAI. And she's a Columbia grad, a Berkeley radical Columbia graduate, who then became part of the Veni Seramos Brigade, among the first American journalists to go to Cuba, blah, blah, blah. Margot's a boring person. She she does All Things Considered in Morning Edition nowadays. She has a new book out.
The vampire book, right? About vampires.
It's about the why vampires are important. It's called Vampires Are Us. And it's about why vampires are so important. And it's an eye-opening work of journalism. And also a lot of fun. And also obsessive. Margot read 270 vampire novels in a row with a break only for American Gods by Neil Gaiman. Because I made her read that. But outside of that, at last count, and that's about 3 months ago when she went to LunaCon, getting her back into... People don't realize Margot's very much in the science fiction world. But I got this radio show because she had to go to California. No, Washington, Seattle, for 6 weeks in the middle of the summer in 1974. She was 73, I'm sorry. Her classmates, Sharon Lee and Steve Miller.
Yes.
Tell me that it was 73. I always get it wrong. In other words, she went to Clarion. She went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, and that's how I ended up getting the show. And she came back. She got a different time slot. And finally left BAI about 1980 because NPR did not appreciate the moonlighting, even though she was unpaid here. They wanted, you know, her exclusive attention. She was a rising star at NPR. So anyway, the point is that if this conversation at all intrigues you about the history of WBAI, and this is but a sliver of the wealth and history, people now, oh yeah, it's that left-wing radio station. Yeah, we're the one on which William F. Buckley started his show. That left-wing radio station. Everybody who now works at Pacifica Radio is cringing saying, what, Freund? As Casey Stengel used to say, you could look it up. Firing line began here, gang. I'm not saying this is what we need to do. I'm saying we are eclectic. I'm saying that that BAI became part of Pacifica Radio in 1960. It existed since the 40s. And when it was donated to the Pacifica Foundation in 1960, Hugh Downs worked here. Steve Allen worked here. And continued doing stuff. Anthony Boucher, who science fiction people will know, worked here as music director. And he did the Golden Age of Opera with horrible, horrible puns, saying, you're about to hear a recording of a castrato. For those who don't know, castrati are people who are cut out to be opera singers. Typical Boucher. Okay. Where else could something like this exist? Nowhere else. That's the answer. Pacifica Radio and WBAR are a unique, as George Alec Effinger used to say. He used to just say, it is a unique. Bad English, but I liked the way he put it. And we is, to keep up that grammar. And the way, and we are in deep, deep, deep doo-doo. We are in deep danger. Google up Pacifica Radio on the news sections and read all about it. Better yet, don't. It's painful. It's really painful. I have worked here now 47 years, and we've gone through some terrible times. We've gone through demonstrations. You can watch the movie Radio Unnameable and see some of them. That's a documentary all about Bob Fass, and it shows a lot of the history of BAI in there, and you can see how dire it has been. It has never been more dire than it is now. If the radio station survives the next 3 months, next 6 months, we'll be in good shape. But I'm not convinced that it will. Okay? And yet, we've heard this before. Maybe we will, and I'll tell you the one chance we have to survive. We have been lucky enough to be self-sustaining. We are making the money that we have in our vastly reduced budget by cutting the staff from 50 to 7. Okay? We have a paid staff of 7. If we are to survive, we need to rebuild. If we are going to rebuild, it is going to be because you are going to pick up the phone now. Dial area code 212-209-2950. And you know how much you're going to pledge? $10 a month. That will make you what we call a BAI buddy. Yes, to become a subscriber, it's $25. Tiddlywinks, I say to that. Become a BAI buddy. $10 a month. That's probably what you pay for HBO. It's $2 more than Netflix. And what we are giving you, the wealth, the richness, and all that, I'm not putting those other services down. I have them. But we're radio. We're the thing that is truly portable. You can hear it on your phone. You can hear it in your car. You can hear it without advanced technology. You can hear it in short stories by Tom Doyle dating back to the 30s. And plural or singular on that?
Stories.
Yes, you have the War of the Worlds.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I have a story that has information in it, the story that talks about time going back in the 30s, and
yes,
American Craftsman goes back to the early 1600s, for that matter.
That's right, but that short story has a lot to do with radio.
Yes, it does.
That was my point. Yeah. Radio is not new media, but it is also not old media. It is media that must survive. Uh-oh. And I want to wrap up this pitching. What I will say is, call up now, 212-209-2950. If you don't do it, by the way, you won't find me on the air again. Because the way our current management is thinking, is I talked to him about what will happen to my time slot, because there are things going on for bad reasons. And he said, well, if you're going to be in that time slot, you have to make $2,000. I said, what? There are some other shows in which they only have to raise $100, 10 BAI buddies. He was a bit silent about that, but you see, that's the goal I'm setting. Oh, but if you'd like to donate $50, 50 clams, you can get a free audiobook called The End Is Nigh, edited by John Joseph Adams. There are, I don't know how many of those we have. He gave me 10. I mean, they're really just codes. When you subscribe, you get a code that allows you to download it from audible.com. Only when it goes into your shopping cart, we'll give you a code that makes it free. Oh. We have up to 10 of those. I think we sold, as it were, a few a month ago. So we have a few of those. So that's for $50. And you can get that 212-209-2950. But this morning, I'm pushing the BAI buddy. $10. 212-209-2950. Having done that, should I start the show proper?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, well, let's. I'm sorry it ran over, but hey, it's freeform radio. And so I'm gonna play my opening theme. How about that? We'll be back with the start of the show. Only 20 minutes late.
Thank you.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weeknight program, mainly, about science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, our guest from Washington, D.C., Tom Doyle. Stay tuned. Okay, well, now we are have formally started the show. So, once again, good morning. I am Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. With me, Tom Doyle.
Well, thank you for having me again here. It's wonderful to be here again.
Yeah, the last time you were here, you weren't here. You were actually at my apartment.
Oh, that's right.
In my house in Brooklyn.
Deepest Brooklyn.
And, yeah, not deepest Southern. The southern end, the southernmost end of Brooklyn. And deep Brooklyn is like, you know, Flatbush.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's the deep part of Brooklyn. Yeah. But I ain't in the deep part of Brooklyn. I'm in...
You're right before the Verrazano Bridge down there, right?
Yeah, well, I'm actually trying not to say that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's all right. Oh, by the way, don't bang the table.
Oh, right.
We talk. It makes a one. If you put on the headphones and then bang the table, you'll hear what it sounds like. It's really cool, but not necessarily to the listeners. So, Tom, when it was last on the show, had just come out with The Wizard of Makatawa.
That's right, my short story collection.
From Golem Press.
Yeah, Paper Golem Press.
Okay.
Lawrence Jones. Small press, and he's done a number of collections of folks that are kind of early on in their careers who've assembled enough short stories and seem to be going on to other places and such, and he gets together their shorts. He did that for Eric James Stone. He did that for Cat Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did a collection of my short work, and it includes a story that won the Small Press Award from WSFA, the title
story. Washington Science Fiction Association.
And that's the title story.
Was that the one that also went on for the Writers of the Future?
No, that was While Ireland Holds These Graves was the Writers of the Future story.
Yeah. And I've had problems dealing with them sometimes because the award is great. The people involved in Writers of the Future are wonderful. It's a worthy award, it's a worthy organization, but it is owned and run by a less worthy group, that being Scientology.
Well, we talked a bit about that at the last one there.
And that was just about when Going Clear by Lawrence Wright had just come out.
Oh, right.
A wonderful book. But for some reason, the Writers of the Future Award is really good, and the things that they do. And it's something to be proud of. And it's really not, it may be owned by, but it's not associated with Scientology in any way, shape, or form. So.
Yeah, no, it was, it was a fun the workshop they did, run by Tim Powers and Nina Kuricki Hoffman.
Yeah.
My year, they were the two workshop runners. That was a great experience being there in L.A.
Neither of whom, to my knowledge, are Scientologists.
Well, the judges, none of them.
Yeah. I love Tim Powers' writing and Nina Kuricki Hoffman. These are two good people. But since then, you have the first book of a trilogy now in print.
The first book, American Craftsman, and it's a three-book series, so yes. maybe things go on longer, but I think there will be a trilogy arc to it, but each book will also be a self-contained story, because I want to give the consumer what they want.
There is closure at the end of American Craftsman.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun.
How
would you describe it?
I would describe it as it's modern day.
That table.
Oh yes,
you're on springs, literally.
It is a modern day fantasy, takes place in our world, of military intrigue, that has magician soldiers and psychic spies, but they are the craftsmen of the title,
right?
And they're
as in the craft.
The craft, as in. And as in witchcraft, as in wizardry,
as in Wicca,
and they go back. Most of them have families that go back all the way to the founding of the country, or at least in the particular, the ones I'm focusing on do. And in that historical backstory, I basically imagined that Poe and Hawthorne were writing thinly veiled nonfiction, and that the early American canon can be read as kind of fanfic of the craftsmen, that they are changing the names, that, for example, the fall of the House of Usher was really about the evil left-hand Mortons, Roderick and Madeline, and the whole live burial element was not an accident.
But despite the description, this does not, unlike Mike Cole's work, this does not really resemble a military fiction novel.
I would say it opens up with the full-on action that you would expect from it.
And the cover.
Yeah, and the cover.
Certainly makes it seem like that.
Yeah. It's more, as far as what drives the plot, it's more of a kind of, I call it military intrigue rather than the sort of, flat-out full of battle scenes, although there are battle scenes, but it also has this historical backstory and this sort of literary element of what informs the magic. Everything comes from Hawthorne, from Poe, from other stories, and it becomes a book that's in love with other books.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And there's a lot of meta, as they say, in there. The referencing of other things that are obvious. I mean, one of the many writers who are on the show, I get to ask, what are your influences, what were you reading when you were young? But this is, I wouldn't say tattooed on your cuff. This is, right there in the book.
And yet someone could read this and, the references that are necessary are all laid out and explained.
Yes.
And so if you want to read it just straight out for the plot, it's quite readable on that level.
For me, it's the kind of book that somebody should read twice. The reading of it reminded me of the reading of American Gods by Neil Gaiman. When I read American Gods, I just read it for the pleasure of the book he was writing, and I knew a lot of the references, especially to the Germanic gods and Wotan and Loki and people like that. But there are all these African gods and other things in there. So I read the book a second time, and once with the paper in my hand and a tablet by my side, and every time I came across one of the meta references, I looked it up and found out, this character You know, Anubis is really like this, and they Anubis is something Tim Powers writes about.
Right. Yeah.
But so on and so forth. And American Craftsman is a book that I intend to reread with a tablet by the side so I can get a lot of the references. First you read the book for the pleasure, and then you can read it again for the pleasure and the...
kind of Easter egg hunting or reference hunting.
The reference hunting, yeah. I mean, Easter egg, yeah, but to me it's more like, let's learn the history here. This is so much fun. Let's see where it goes.
I've done a series of guest blog posts, and a few of them are perhaps useful as sources of annotation for some of the material.
Which is similar to what Gaiman did, because Gaiman himself, and he had his Uber fans, had a lot of information about the book. But you know, Gaiman has reached, you know, he's one notch below George Martin in popularity at this point, and in some ways above George. But when American Gods hits HBO, which would be in a couple of years, because they have bought it.
Yes. Is it going to take that long, a couple of years before?
Well, they haven't started.
Okay.
And you can imagine. Have you read the book?
Oh, yeah. I've read the...
Well, you tell me how long it's going to take to film that.
Well, yeah, no, I don't know. They gin out those Game of Thrones seasons, you know, every year.
But it takes George 6 years, right? And famously, by the way, at last year's Worldcon, George is out, and people are saying, "When's the next book? When's the next book?" And Neil Gaiman came out and said, "George Martin is not HBO's bitch,
yeah. or not yours." You know, in general,
That's not what Neil said.
Oh, I thought he did
it's
an essay.
YouTube.
Oh, what he said live. Okay, versus essay he did.
No, this is at WorldCon on stage.
Okay.
It's on YouTube.
Okay.
People can just look it up. Neil Gaiman, George Martin. It was an event, and that's a direct quote.
Well, because he had done an essay before where the title didn't reference HBO. It was a general addressed to all the fans saying he's not yours.
Yeah.
You know,
I totally agree. And between you and me and the lamppost, I love George R. R. Martin's writing. I don't go near Game of Thrones. I started reading the Fire and Ice books, and I thought, this is not for me. Too much gore, too much explicit arterial spouting and stuff like that. And then on screen, they go well beyond that. It's what people call gornography. And that's, for me, that's not entertainment. American Craftsman, on the other hand, was a delight.
I used to, when I was a lawyer back in the 90s, in ancient times, my law office had Sandman, Neil Gaiman's graphic novel series.
Mm-hmm.
Had Sandman posters on it. You know, most people had like their law diplomas or their undergrad diplomas or pictures of their family or something. And mine was covered with the various posters that came out on a regular basis.
That's
from the
cool.
Sandman volumes.
Yeah.
And people said I really didn't belong at the firm after...
What kind of a legal firm... What kind of lawyer were you?
I was a... Well, at the first part, I was working on a big product liability action that got me to Japan for a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
And that was a lot of... The Japan part was a lot of fun.
Okay.
And
so
then,
basically corporate law.
Well, it was... That was actually product... That was a tort, big tort action, a big product liability thing. Then it became corporate law when I came back and was working on... mortgage-backed security transactions and all those other fun things that came back to bite the economy pretty hard there.
Now, what are you doing for a living at this time?
Well, I'm writing full-time.
You are? Okay.
So I get to do that. But
so
based on based on the savings from those years, I just squirreled it all away from from those days. And so now, yeah, I get
because
to.
Because writing science fiction is not necessarily a big living except for a very small percentage of the writers.
Oh, yeah. And if I had not done that saving, it would not be, even now with a three-book deal, would not be feasible yet. No.
Yeah. No. And different publishers can afford different things. And a genre publisher, this was true of Ballantine Books, and it's, you know, generally true of Tor, which is where you're being published, and some of the others, the genre publishers don't have the budgets of Random House, Knopf, and...
Yeah, I mean, the you know, that's... It fluctuates, it seems. It's like, it seems they're the at 2008, nothing new was happening for a while in terms of deals. And now
it's getting better.
It is
getting better. And I'm so pleased and happy that this has happened for you because, you know, I am a true supporter of the short story. And I know that you are as well. But... Yes. You know, unless you have a paper golem press or something like that, and those are few and far between, and he can only turn out so many books, Lawrence Young can only turn out so many books at a time, short story collections by people who don't have novels are very rare. I mean, there's Ted Chiang. Can we name a second?
I'm sure that there are a bunch of them, but they're hard to name.
Hard to name. There are very few people who can just write short stories. Karen Russell, and even then, she has a novel.
Yeah, Howard Waldrop had some novels, but he predominantly.
But predominantly is the word.
Yeah.
But exclusively short stories getting into print.
Yeah.
As a first book.
No.
Doesn't generally happen. So, for me, not only is American Craftsman fun. Why do you call the whole trilogy, by the way?
I think it's going to be the American Craftsman series, or the, you know, like book two will be the second book of the American Craftsman, and put it that way. But we'll see if the Tor goes with that. They just got back the edit letter on book two, which is going to be called The Left Hand Way. And that's kind of the...
So it'll probably be American Craftsman, colon.
Yeah, or The Left-Hand Way, book two of The American Craftsman, or something like that. And
we'll see how they market it.
Yeah. And so that's... For the trilogy arc, that's my Empire Strikes Back. And in the sense of left-hand is a euphemism for the path of evil in my book, so... To call a book The Left Hand Way is basically kind of saying The Empire Strikes Back in a way.
Fair enough. How did you study the craft? Where did you get your concepts of magic from?
There were two main sources. One is, as I was saying, the early American canon. So as an example of a power... My protagonist, Captain Dale Morton, he can see people's sins in that sort of, as in the Scarlet Letter, some people could see on the preacher the glowing letter of his sin, even though, unlike Hester Prynne, he didn't wear a cloth version of it. They could still see it radiating from him. And so the Mortons have that ability. That people's sins are almost like a psychological profile radiating from them, almost a psychological signature of what they've been up to. So that's something that I took out of Hawthorne and gave to Dale Morton. On the other hand, there had to be abilities that made sense to kind of explain the uncanny in American history and particularly American military history. And one of the most uncanny things that consistently happens is that certain changes in the weather lead to the saving of Washington's army at Brooklyn Heights, the success of the D-Day invasion. Very abrupt and fortuitous changes in weather made a huge difference many times for Washington, and then later on in history. So
Queen
I thought
Elizabeth's history.
Yes,
different.
and book two gets into that one, but that's okay. When we get further afield. But so there's an example of a power, you know, over the weather that I just derived not from the early American canon, but by what sort of powers would have made a difference if you assume a kind of crypto history where these people are active and powerful and changing things, but in a way that doesn't get seen by the formal history.
Well, why don't we get a piece?
Oh, sure.
Of the book. Do you want to take a break first?
I'm actually okay. I'll
yeah,
take
you're
a sip
okay
of water.
With your water and refreshment mm-hmm. and all that. Okay, then, anytime you are ready. This is about 20, 25 minutes, if I'm...
It's probably towards the 25 minute.
Yeah.
I think so.
And since we're already at 2:15.
We better get going.
Time to get cracking on it.
So, and there... But
there's no precy needed.
No.
Going to the start of the book.
Yeah, go right to it. Some of the words have been changed for our radio audience. But
yes, I mean, if you were at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings last night, and why weren't you? Better question, why weren't you there last Friday? That was a great event, and it was an empty room. We had like 10 people. For the winners of the Audi Awards for Best Fantasy. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So I
will get going on this, though. It's so it begins with part one, The Veterans of 1,000 Psychic Wars, and begins with two quotes. And he was bent on making us feel as he did, and of course, his magic accomplished his desire. And that's from Mark Twain. Your magic errand boys just made a bad guess again. And that's from Allen Ginsberg. 1. As I hustled out from the hangar into the Persian Gulf twilight, my muscles tightened and power flowed into my hands. Soon I would do what I did best. Soon I would kill a sorcerer. The U.S. Army base tarmac gave off a blistering heat mirage as I scrambled across it. A helicopter's blades rotated at ready, their wash blasted hot as I boarded. The door slammed behind me, and the copter, christened Valkyrie, took off. The 5 men of my team saluted and then went back to checking their equipment. They showed no impatience at having waited on the pad for orders. They were used to the bullcrap. I sat towards the front for quick off-headphone interaction with the pilot when we hit the spooky stuff. For a silent aircraft, the Valkyrie made plenty of noise inside. Next to me, Corporal Vulture Vallant yelled my nom de guerre. Casper, is that like the friendly ghost, sir? Not that friendly, Corporal. A killing ghost, sir? But seeing that I was unamused, Vulture again inspected his sniper rifle, and I was grateful that I didn't have to order him to shut the heck up. It wasn't my fault. It was my fault for choosing a crappy cryptonym, and not just because of the ghost reference. Casper gave a clue to my job. Casper, or Caspar, had been one of the three wise men, a magus, or what Americans with knowledge called a craftsman. Why hide my identity only to give it away through the back door? My father had written me a warning that we Mortons are too practical about the craft and too crafty about the practical. Yeah, my real name was Morton, Captain Dale Morton. Other craftsmen tended to have strong opinions about my family. I didn't blame them. My men didn't know about my family or magic, but they aimed uncomfortable glances at me. I didn't blame them either. These 5 had trained together, a seamless whole, but not with me. I was too important a secret to expose to others for too much time. Our unit designation, MAC-66, appeared in no records. The Pentagon didn't formally acknowledge Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, but allowed their existence to be known. Craft ops were different. Knowledge of their existence could be fatal. Two of my five were boot camps. Green is Uncle Sam's toilet paper. Vulture and Lieutenant Shaheen were more experienced. Shaheen knew Arabic and regional detail and doubled as team medic, so he was Doc. And there was the old man, my NCO, Master Sergeant Z's and all. All good men, but I couldn't get too close. They were smart enough not to question the bullcrap, but they would know the word from this land to describe me. Assassin. Hours before, I had stood in a prefab conference room shoved into the corner of the base hangar. The room served as an office for people who weren't officially there. Colonel Hutchinson had explained my mission. She was my favorite officer, my favorite craftsperson, and my favorite living human being, all packed tight into a tall 40-something mix of Kate Hepburn and triathlete. Atrine is calling it a snatch and grab, but you'll assume your usual prejudice against the target, she said in her easy rural New England way, as if she weren't sentencing some stranger to death. Intel says he's a Farsi speaker, a Persian. Persian, better than any existing nation's name to describe ancient loyalties. Hutchinson pointed to a printout map. He's been Farsiing here, about 50 clicks southwest of the bridge. A long ways from home, ma'am, I said. He's not such a wise man for a Magus, said Hutchinson. We expect to go before sundown. Isn't Sword up next? Codename Sword was the third craftsperson on base, though for security I was kept sequestered from him. I wanted this mission, but I had a gut suspicion of irregular assignments. This mission's been called by Sphinx herself, said Hutchinson, and Sphinx doesn't want Sword. She said something to the effect that if we didn't send you on this mission, we could pack up Western civilization and shove it up our butts. Me, ma'am? As far as I knew, neither the peep show at Langley nor their top oracle Sphinx ever selected the individual for an assignment. Don't let it go to your head, Morton. This bozo isn't important. Must be a butterfly effect scenario. So I crushed the butterfly, I said. Right, agreed Hutchinson. I respected Hutchinson more than my rarely seen parents, and whatever Hutch said, I would execute with my usual and extreme prejudice. But it was more than personal loyalty. I shared the sense of duty of my ancestors. Philip Foggy Morton, who delayed the British with bad weather at Brooklyn Heights to save George Washington's army. Richard Dick Morton, who calmed the storms over the English Channel for the D-Day invasion. And Joshua Morton, who gave the last full measure for the Union he loved. Like them, I would serve my country to the utmost. I checked my watch. We'd be within 40 clicks by now. We were coming in low and below radar, but I wasn't worried about the conventional firepower of the locals. The target would strike soon. I kept my anticipation of the supernatural blow to myself. The first sign of attack came as a gut-lurching sideways dropped, followed by another. The chopper shook as if an oversized child was pelting it with boulders. Yes, a probable spactad, spooky action at a distance. I clambered forward and crouched behind the pilot, Lieutenant Nguyen. She had "Born to Kill" on her helmet. What's that turbulence? I asked. Sir, we need to turn back, said Nguyen. Just because of some wind? Look at this, said Nguyen. On the radar, a wall of disturbance moved towards us. Sandstorm. Fly above it? I've never seen anything go so high, said Nguyen. Keep flying, I said. We'll be fine. But, sir, that's an order. Yes, sir. Fortunately, Nguyen had been thoroughly warned to follow my every order, no matter how apparently suicidal. But she didn't sound happy, no ma'am. I made a controlled tumble back into my seat and held some laminated maps in front of my face. But my mind followed the storm. I felt the enemy craftwork behind it, craftwork that had been wreaking havoc on air and land traffic in this sector for months. I could try to fight the whole spell, but I wasn't on my own ground, so that would drain me, and that was probably what the target wanted. So I'd shield the copter. It would look strange, but what could the pilot say? I touched my hand to the wall of the aircraft and rubbed and patted it like a horse. I felt the pulse of the life of the air beyond. Calm air, I murmured, and the air around the speeding copter flowed calmly by. My headset crackled. Sir, said Nguyen, the sand is blowing, but we seem to be in a clear pocket. Roger that. Carry on, Lieutenant. Compulsively, I checked my weapons and gear again, way beyond the necessary. I carried a Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun with its clean first shot and a Sig Sauer P226 9mm pistol because I didn't want to adapt my father's .45 with the electronic safeguards. My team's equipment appeared standard for a special ops unit, but it had hidden features for craft-enhanced ops. The surest weapon in a craftsman's hands is his opponent's mind. Each weapon had a stonewall chip that would prevent firing at a team member, including oneself, under any circumstances. I smiled at the chip's name. As my ancestor Joshua Morton had illustrated to General Jackson at the end of an otherwise bad day at Chancellorsville, getting the enemy to shoot their own took very little craft. After the mission, the team would be kept under 24/7 surveillance and quarantine for a month in case any craft time bombs had been dropped into their psyches. I grimaced in sympathy, but their minds wouldn't be great concerns if I eliminated the target quickly. The men had technical explanations for these safeguards. Too much sci-fi channel had accustomed them to all kinds of nonsense, that they might be subject to chemical hallucinogens, microwave mind control, or perfect holographic projections. Like Dad had written, any sufficiently advanced magic is indistinguishable from technology. For a long mission, another man might carry amphetamines or other stimulants. I carried only one pill, a black cyanide capsule, and in case I hesitated, there was an exception to the stonewall chip. One man in the unit would have the order and the means to kill me rather than allow my capture. I bet it was Sergeant Z. I felt the G's as the copter veered right. Sir, said Nguyen on the headset, we're about two clicks from the target location, approaching from due south. I didn't look up from my equipment. Keep flying north, full speed. But the target is... He'll run, I said. I moved forward again for a face-to-face. But we're coming in quiet, said Nguyen. He knows that we're coming. The pilot looked at me, horrified at this hint of a security breach. I viewed the ground through the copter's night vision screen. Sure enough, far ahead on the lone road leading out of the village, a jeep raced towards the north. In night vision, the jeep glowed bright green with heat, but in my vision, the target burned red with craft. Perhaps if the target had tried to flee quietly without throwing sand in our faces, he would have made it, but that wasn't Magi style. That's our man. Try not to lose him. Yes, sir. If the target was talented enough, he would shake us with some sorcerer's stealth unless I could guess where he was heading. That's why I was here, and not some predator drone. This chase required craft and intuition. Where will he run to? My objectives liked old ground. Any other place I could just pick out the nearest ruin. But here in the Near East, ancient sites with occult potential dotted the landscape. Wait, there on the map, straight down the road, a familiar name. Drones had seen some recent small unit activity in the area, but that wasn't what concerned me. I stepped back to show the map to Doc. Isn't there an archaeological site here? Yes, sir, an Assyrian settlement near the town. Looters have been digging pits during the recent unpleasantness. Pilot, head to MC 914642-11. Roger Wilco. Wait a minute. He's off the scope, sir. Understood. Circle the point where you last saw him for 10 minutes. Then head to MC9146-4211 on a curved vector, veering 30 degrees west of True until midpoint. I didn't want the target to see us pursuing in a straight line behind him, and I didn't want to beat the target to the sight. I called up maps and photos of the dig on my handheld. Yes, an old tunnel excavation into a nasty temple to Asir Marduk. The target would like that. And something more organized than looting had been going on in the last 2 years, with the maze of tunnels opened up to the surface, then covered from view with a series of tarpaulins. I turned to Sergeant Z and pointed at my map. Let's run through the mission. We'll insert a few kilometers downwind of the town here. It was a small town with a long Arabic name, and before that a Greek name, and before that something in Assyrian, and something else before all that. Every place they sent me was like that. Small towns with large history lessons.
Don't make me pronounce it right, sir, said Z. I just forget them all afterwards.
Doesn't matter, I said. Our objective won't go to the modern town. The drones have spotted activity just to the west in the excavated mound.
What kind of activity, sir?
Hostile activity. Z didn't need to know about all the other aberrant sandstorms and equipment failures. Like me and many of my ancestors, my target was a weatherman. Vulture will clear the entrance to the dig. Then you'll all cover the town and any approaching bad guys. Any conventional bad guys.
You going into the tell alone, sir?
That's correct. Odd that Z knew the word tell.
An ancient city?
He narrowed his eyes at me.
I've seen some strange missions, sir. A crypt in the bottom of a mine in Bosnia. A temple older than the Mayans in Central America. I don't like that kind of strangeness, but it doesn't frighten me.
I hear you, Sergeant. The man was saying that he understood something about craft ops, that I could rely on him not to panic in the face of magic and to keep his mouth shut afterwards, that I could talk to him, that I didn't have to go into those ruins alone. But craft was different from most military secrets. Besides, I preferred to hit the target myself. A mundane soldier was just somebody I'd have to protect.
We'll talk afterwards, I continued, so we understand each other. No one else is to enter the ruins under any circumstances. You understand my orders, Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Having completed my checklist, I prepared my most important weapon, my craft. I focused on my breathing to find my center. I hit the mute button on my senses. The chopper engines, the camouflage colors, the smells of fuel, equipment, and sweat, all perceived through foam insulation. Very internal, intimate time. Turn the lights down low, baby. Some of this quiet bubble was common to most elite soldiers before a mission, but some of it was the peculiar meditation needed for my power. Ritual and formula were just two possible focal points for magic. The essence of craft was to hold two exact images in one's mind at once, the thing as it was and the thing as it would be. Then, still holding the images, the craftsman placed the word of action between them. To do all this instantaneously required talent, practice, and energy. But with my power running high, one of my natural gifts showed itself without effort. The team's auras flickered around me, the small letters of their sins, scarlet A's of petty fornications, and K's of military duty, tried to distract me. I ignored them. In my bubble, I waited. I was alone. Nothing else existed. I felt the craft energies flow up and down my spine. More than enough juice for one sorcerer. I was ready. Nguyen signaled. 2 minutes. I resurfaced. I mumbled a prayer to an absent god that
This time, my team would just face flesh and bullets, leaving the more powerful horrors to me. Get ready. The copter slowed to a hover. Move out. The metal door flew open with a side slam, and we were down the ropes and fanning out through the clouds of dust in a scattered deployment. Better for this sort of op that, until it was done, the aircraft not touch the ground or stick around too long. The pilot swooped away like a bat copter from hell. My night vision goggles gave the world a greenish hue. Unlike most special operations forces, this unit had no video equipment. No recording of a craft op would ever be made. No amount of operation review could justify the inevitable leak that would endanger all practitioners. Let's move. We started jogging towards the tell. I loved the desert at night. Human beings seemed like a blot on its purity. Cumin, nutmeg, cardamom, lamb, exhaust. Sure enough, the inevitable smell of Middle Eastern cuisine mixed with diesel wafted over from the town, making me hungry and queasy at the same time. I hoped the civilians would, unlike their smells, stay at home. Home and safe from me and my team. We found cover behind the piles of moved earth. An all-weather tarpaulin, the first of many over the dig, made a tent-like roof to the mound entrance. Its loose corners wagged or flapped in the wind. Someone had organized the digging and the tarps, creating a flimsy yet safer ceiling for their ancient home. Two bad guys stood guard at the entrance, talking, one in a burnous, the other in a deracinated uniform. Doc listened with a parabolic mic, a craft op standard, and sent me their text. Herd chopper, concerned. Not concerned enough by half. They were lighting cigarettes which glowed like flares in my night vision. But the guards didn't glow with craft. Vulture lined them up in his silencer's sight. Conventional means for conventional people. Always better to take life with a bullet, as the law of karmic return was more lenient and indirect with non-magical action. Two bullets snapped. Unavoidable sounds, but they didn't matter. Any target worth his craft would be tipped off at this point. I let go of the breath I had held. Thanks, Vulture. Then I turned to Doc. Keep the site sequestered. Talk any civilians out of coming near. We want zero casualties for us and them. I'm going in. 60 minutes. Mark. No craft duel had ever lasted longer than an hour, if the craftspeople meant business. Simply not enough energy in one person to go longer at full throttle. A battle with multiple practitioners relieving each other in shifts could go on longer, but that didn't happen very often. If I wasn't back in an hour, I was dead or a danger to my own team or something worse. Outside the hangar, Colonel Hutchinson shook her head at her other favorite killer, codenamed Sword. In contrast to Morton's dark features, Native American cheekbones, and expressive mien, Major Sword's blonde hair and nor'easter gray eyes framed a long, angular face of iron. That face had just gotten harder. Poor boy was understandably pissed. Sword pointed at the red horizon, eyes on Hutchinson. Was that my mission that just took off, Colonel? No, said Hutchinson. That was Casper's mission that just took off, Major. The Major's real name was Michael Endicott. If he had known Casper's real name, he would have been more pissed. The Major's ancestors were the Endicotts of Salem. Sure, he could serve under her, a Hutchinson, descended from that notorious heretic woman. Hell, the boy actually seemed to like and respect her. But she doubted he could extend that tolerance to Captain Morton. The pagan Mortons, with their craft, were anathema to the Puritan Endicotts and their gifts of the spirit. A shame, because she was fond of both Dale and Michael, and would have loved to see them fight together against enemies foreign and domestic. But ever since 1628, when John Endicott and his men had attacked Thomas Morton's colonial settlement, the two families had feuded, and had even tried to exclude each other from the secret covenant that George Washington had made with all the Kraft families in return for their service during the Revolution. Then the left-hand Mortons had scared the crap out of everyone, and the Endicotts had never let the later generations of Mortons forget it. Casper went under your orders, Colonel? Hutchinson knew where this was going. My orders came from higher up, Major. Endicott looked about to shrapnel. Permission to speak freely, ma'am? What the hell is it, Michael? Hutch, don't these sudden changes in assignment bother you? They sure seem to bother you, said Hutchinson. But you never appreciate assignment by farsight. This is different, Endicott lowered his voice. If the peep show and our precog can't agree, it means something powerful is blocking one of their farsights. The general says it could be a sign that they are back. Hutch snorted. Michael's father, General Oliver C. Endicott, had never liked Sphinx or her peep show, kissed Pentagon farsight butt, and was close to discharge insane about the imminent return of the left-hand Mortons. Okay, Michael. Never mind that those evil kinscrewers have all been exterminated. Let's hold that branch of ancient history over the heads of the modern Mortons like a cudgel. Make them keep toeing the line. Never let them above the active rank of captain, because God knows they haven't saved our butts enough to trust them again. Endicott's face cracked into a small grimace. It's not like that, Hutch. Just don't be surprised if something goes wrong. Hutchinson's tough heart skipped a beat. Dread, then anger, used up her remaining patience with all things Endicott. That had better not be an oracle, Major.
No, ma'am.
Good. Then get packing, soldier. You're due in Prague tomorrow.
Prague? Poor boy sounded positively wounded by the new assignment. Hutchinson tried not to chuckle.
Yes, Prague. I'll brief you in the conference room in 1 hour.
She hesitated, trying to separate the threads of command instinct from an almost maternal concern, until she found they agreed.
But I'm keeping you here tonight.
Because she refused to be surprised if something went wrong. And, of course, something does go horribly wrong, but that's...
So, let's see. Now, you stopped at a different point than where you stopped yesterday.
No, that's the exact same point.
That was the same point. Okay.
That was the same point.
I was just thrown because I marked the end of the chapter in here.
Oh, no, I didn't.
You didn't go to
the
end of the chapter.
I just went to the end of that section.
And here I was trying to cue up an appropriate song to follow.
Well, let's follow up then.
Well, I didn't quite have it at that point. Okay, give me a moment.
Well, I'll just go on to explain that something.
Two songs. Yeah, go ahead.
Something does indeed go horribly wrong about as wrong as you can imagine, and Dale is left with this shattered mission and trying to explain, and a shattered psyche for that matter, and he goes on a hunt to find out what went wrong and what can go wrong in a world where there's so much precognition, so much prophetic prediction. He assumes that there is indeed a mole at the heart of the Kraft services, some kind of traitor, something wrong at the heart of things, and something seems to be continuing to try to get him killed as well, and that's what drives the plot.
Okay. Now, I wasn't able to find, so I was looking for something that involved war and magic.
Oh.
But I couldn't easily, not in time. So,
how about Veteran of a Thousand Psychic Wars?
Okay, I don't know that song.
If you have it on there, Blue Oyster Cult. Lyrics by Michael Moorcock.
Oh, okay, fine. So, title again?
The Veteran of a Thousand Psychic Wars. Or Veteran of the Psychic Wars, actually.
Veteran
it doesn't have the thousand.
See, I don't... even Moorcock stuff. I actually know his stuff better with Hawkwind than I know his stuff with Blue Oyster Cult.
Or there's that one, or there's ETI.
We're already...
Okay, we're queued up.
Okay, so, we're queued, and we are there. Stay tuned.
there's anything left to me. To let these shakes go on, it's time we had a break from it. It's time we had to leave. We've been living in the flames. We've been eating up our brains. Oh, please don't let these shakes go on. You ask me why I'm weary, why I can't speak to you. You blame me for my silence, say it's time I changed the rule. But the war's still going on, dear, and there's no end.
And you are tuned, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And you've been listening to, before Blue Oyster Cult, a portion of Chapter 1, that's how I got caught unawares, because I was reading along, from the novel American Craftsman, read for you by the author Tom Doyle. So that it's a fun piece. It was a little more explicit, a little saltier, last, a little more army-like.
Yeah.
When you read it last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Yeah, I got, you know, had to have that sort of military verisimilitude there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh so. Yeah. I did a Coast Guard reading once at the nearest of readings, which was Mike Cole and Bob Howe.
Oh, okay.
And Mike Cole, this is just when his first book was out.
Yes.
And he was relaxed and happy and, oh, boy, and...
Can I just say thank God for Mike Cole right here in public?
If you want, sure.
I want to say that right now because... But, or thank whoever.
Okay, but I'm in the middle of the story.
I'll let you go on. Okay, but I just, I'll explain why later.
Oh, okay, fine. But he... And he was relaxed, and you know, bit of the swagger and all that. Mm-hmm. Day of publication and all that, and all of a sudden he's as stiff as a board. Some guy walks in wearing civvies, but it doesn't matter. Mike is like a board, and he walks up and he says, "Thank you, sir. It's an honor to have you here." Yeah. It was the CO.
Oh.
It was the Coast Guard CO came to the reading, and Mike is active as a lieutenant, and oh my God, it was quite something. Anyway, Mike did his reading. It was very funny, very good. Not so funny, but because his book, it has humor, but nonetheless, it was very good. And then came Bob Howe. Bob Howe, who's a very good writer and mostly does short stories, gets up and he says, "Okay, you just listen to the fiction of an officer. I'm an enlisted man." And boy, can I not broadcast what Bob read, but it was great. And so I just thought that was the point of that story.
Well,
but it was hilarious to watch him when the CO.
Oh, yes.
I mean, for God's sakes, the CO. I mean, that's, I guess, for New York or for the East Coast. I don't know what, but it's a high-ranking officer came in. And we're all like going, ooh, look at that. And we're all watching Mike.
Oh, yeah.
And just, you know, just transform into, he's not, when I met him, he didn't describe himself. I said, "Oh, what do you do?" He said, "I'm a cop."
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then later on, I find out he's with the Coast Guard. And I thought you said you're a cop. He said, "I am. What do you think the Coast Guard is?" It's military, but they're cops. It's a different kind of thing. So why thank God for Michael?
Well, because he established that something that was both contemporary and military in fantasy could, you know, be a book and get out there. He basically established this market
reestablished.
Yeah. And he was out there doing that, you know, because when I was trying to sell this book before his stuff came out, people would go, "Well, what? This is neither fish nor fowl. What are we dealing with here?" As he put it when he was telling the story about him trying to sell his, this is a book that doesn't know its market. Well, the book knows its market, you know, it's just it hadn't been recognized as a niche yet. So that's why I say, you know, blessings of the universe upon him.
Yeah. But you're also lucky to have, you know, tour books and a good publicist and Artie. She does a great job.
It was great to meet her last night.
Oh, you hadn't met her before?
I had been communicating with her through all channels, but hadn't met her in person before.
Oh, yeah. No, she's great. She's great. And, a publicist, you know, sometimes I will call up a company and say, you know, "I want to interview this person. I want to book from that person." And sort of like, "Who are you? What do you do?" And at a reading, this woman comes up to me, book in hand, and she says, "Hi, I'm Artie. I'm the publicist at Tor Books. Here are a couple of books I think you should read, and I can get you interviews."
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, there's a person doing her job.
Oh, and she...
How many science fiction radio shows do we have here? Or TV? Or
She told me she likes you. She likes she likes what you do. So
okay,
she you know, it's going, "Well, is there anything else I should be doing in New York?" So you're going to Jim's stuff. You're doing the right stuff. So
good. I'm pleased to hear that. We only have a few minutes left, although I do not see Lister coming down the halls, but I will start recordings at 3 a.m. if needs be, because you have a train to catch. I have a bed to find. But we have a few minutes in which to take calls. Put on your headphones.
Oh, sure.
And the number to pledge is 212-209-2950. And the number to call, I see now that call just went away, is 212-209-2900 to talk on the air, 2950 to pledge. What happens is people call up, and if it rings too many times and I don't see it, it falls off the board into the world of of no call. We had two calls, and now they're both like, eh. And I'm not sure that we can get more than two calls at a time, you know, but let's try that again. Okay. Hi there, you're on the radio.
Good morning, Mr. Doyle and James. I'm sorry I missed you last night. I think I'm going to love American Craftsman.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Military history and magic. I love both. I have a question about Mr. Morton.
Oh, yes.
You think there was a Mr. Morton back in the English Channel in August of 1588 with Frobisher, Stanley, and the boys?
There is a story about that, and that story, though, gets told in book two.
Ooh, I'm going to love it.
Yeah, there indeed. That weather phenomenon.
And the poor Spanish dons never even knew what hit them,
oh,
right?
Well, it was, you know, both sides were, like, thoroughly engaged, but fortunately for England, England prevailed.
You
so.
Know, it's interesting. It would be very...
By the way, I have to warn you both. We have 90 seconds.
Yeah, I was going to say one more thing. It would be very interesting to go back even further to the year 1281 and find out, perhaps, if the Japanese had a Morton-type figure when the great invasion fleet of Kublai tried to hit Japan, and we know the miracle kamikaze?
Yes, yes. The divine wind occurred to me a few times when I was coming up with this magic as well. So well, you're right on it, yes.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So, website.
Website is TomDoyleWriter.com.
TomDoyle Writer.
Yes.
And there's a lot of audio fiction on that website. A lot of readings of a lot of good short stories and all kinds of stuff there.
Links to texts of stories, audio, me reading stories. So all kinds of fun stuff and to tide you over after you read American Craftsman.
So. Yeah. So when you've just turned in book two, so what's the lead time? How long before we'll see?
Tentative is August 2015 for
That's
book
two. That's not bad.
So, yeah, not too bad. Just over.
Because there can be, I mean, sometimes, you know, 2-3 year lead times. And, you know, you mentioned Michael Moorcock. Moorcock could have 5 years between books. Sometimes, and P.J. Farmer, even worse.
Oh.
Philip Jose Farmer. The problem there was he took 5 years before he started writing the next book. Another story. But shockingly, we are out of time. It has been 2 hours since we went on the air, and I thank you so much for coming here. We will do this again.
This is always such a great pleasure. Thank you very much for
having
me. Thank
you. And, you know, whether we do this again, how we do this again, is all dependent on if there is a WBAI. And the only way that you will know that there is a WBAI is if you call and pledge at 212-209-2950. You can also go to the WBAI website at WBAI.org. Choose to pledge there, and then there's a little drop-down box, and you say your favorite show, and your favorite show is Hour of the Wolf, isn't it? This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Thank Tom Doyle for being back on the program. This is the third time, and there will be a fourth and a fifth, you know, whether it's BAI, podcast, whatever, we'll find out. So thanks again.
Thank you.
And we'll be, I don't know when we'll be back. We're continuing this fundraising drive through next week. Will I be here? I don't know. Stay tuned. I'll be here in 2 weeks with a guest. I'm forgetting who. Later on this month, Rick Bowes, oh, all kinds of people. Kate Baker. Kate Baker in 2 weeks.
Oh, excellent.
Yes.
So, excellent reader.
Oh, she's wonderful. So, again, thank you all for listening. We go out with Steel Ice Pan and Sails of Silver and then recorded programming.
unless he flouts the conventions and the conditions that exist, he's not a comedian. Then he's just telling jokes up there. Why does a chicken cross the street? But if he wants to comment on something, then he's going to get in trouble.
Hi, I'm Aura Bogado, and this is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault, the vault, the vault, the vault, the vault, the vault.
That's the 5 a.m. show, and I have to figure out how this thing is here. I'm trying to play. From the Vault is the next thing, is what goes on after Lister, but Lister isn't here, so I'm looking to put on one of these two-hour shows they've got. And not quite sure exactly how that's going to happen. So bear with me. We will all listen together as Jim tries to figure out the station playlist studio software technology. I have this list. I see the problem. Okay, that's all the way down there. That's the 5:30 show. But this is what I've clicked, and then I hit play. Is this take charge of your health? Or is this a promo? Yeah, this is the right show. Okay, so stay tuned. Be sure to do what these people tell you to do, which is to pledge to WBAI at 212-209-2950. Why? Because.
Welcome back. Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health, and I'm Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant. And every week, I present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, I give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Now, within that tradition, today we have a special show. I'm very pleased to be here. Today we have an extended show, and it is a fundraiser. So I'm always proud to come here before you to help you support your radio station, WBAI. It's always a pleasure. It's work, but it's a pleasure because WBAI deserves your support. If you see the work that is done over here, if you see how hard the engineers work to keep these shows going, keep it all together with that dramatic move, you know, you would be very impressed, and I am impressed. We deserve your support. We've had it for 53 years now. It's coming on, I think it's coming on 53, maybe 52, 53. I lose count when we're having fun. And you're our only sponsor. So today, to kind of help you along, and also within the tradition of my show, help you understand health situations in their entirety so you get life choices. Today's show is, I've brought a very special premium. The premium is Waking the Warrior Goddess by Dr. Christine Horner. Dr. Christine Horner is a board-certified and nationally recognized breast reconstructive surgeon and general surgeon. She's a champion for women's health. She spearheaded the legislation in 1990 that made it mandatory that insurance companies pay for breast reconstruction following mastectomy, because they weren't doing it. She is the author of the book, Waking the Warrior Goddess, Dr. Christine Horner's program to protect and fight breast cancer. And this book is a winner. It won the award for Best Book in Medicine and Nutrition and Health. It's quite a book. I was completely taken aback and impressed by this book and reading it. It is a page-turner. But something happened this week that I really wanted to focus on. Well, let me finish. Let's jump back. I had so many things today. So I brought this book. This is our My Premium. And I also did an hour and 15-minute long interview that is exclusive for WBAI. And that's a CD with Dr. Christine Horner, asking her questions about breast cancer prevention, about foods and what to eat, and is it really possible to prevent breast cancer? Or is that just a misnomer? And we just had literally one of the most exciting conversations that I have had in relationship to this health issue. And it's an hour and 15 minutes. So we've got the book, very unique perspective in this book, explaining issues, but also giving you directions. And as we go on, I will explain more about that. Plus, we have an exclusive interview for WBAI, and that's a CD. That's $100. The book is Waking the Warrior Goddess, Dr. Christine Horner's Program to Protect Against and Fight Breast Cancer. And it's a winner of the award for Best Book in Medicine, Nutrition, and Health. So someone else saw it also. What a wonderful book this is. So this week, there were some very profound revelations. Angela Jolie wrote up the fact that she had a double mastectomy. And I want to read a quote from Angela. And this was a very, well, life-changing, profound choice that she made. And let me read this to you. Once I knew that this was my reality, I decided to be proactive and to minimize the risk as much as I could, she wrote. I made decisions to have a preventive double mastectomy. I started with the breast, as my risk of breast cancer is higher than my risk of ovarian cancer, and the surgery is more complex. So the next step is an oophorectomy, removal of her ovaries. So when I heard that, I said, you know, we need information. And this is striking fear into many, many women. So I contacted Dr. Horner and did a second interview specifically on this issue, on the BRCA gene, on the risk factors in relationship to the BRCA gene, the gene which Angela Jolie has, which reduces, increases her risk and reduces her ability to fight and resist breast cancer. So we're going to go right into that, and then we're going to come back. Once you've heard Dr. Horner, you're going to want to hear the rest of this whole interview. Okay? So today and this week was really profound in the revelation that Angela Jolie had chosen to remove her breasts due to having the BRCA gene. What does that mean? What does it mean for us? How should we evaluate that? In order to help us understand, it's a very profound act and very decisive act. I asked Dr. Christine Horner, who we are going to be speaking with this whole 2 hours, so this was absolutely perfect. Dr. Christine Horner is a surgeon. She specialized for many years in breast reconstructive surgery. She also was spokesperson for the American Cancer Society. So, Dr. Horner, could you help us understand this? What is the BRCA gene and what does it mean to us?
Sure. So first of all, let's talk about genes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So in the center of every cell is our DNA, and our DNA is composed of chromosomes. They look like X's, and on the chromosomes are smaller segments that are called genes. And the genes are things that are codes, and they give instructions for our body structure and physiology function. So a number of years ago, not that long ago, there was a big push to map out the human genome, called the Human Genome Project. So that was finally completed, and since then, researchers have really focused on looking at how everything will interact with our genes. And not all of our genes express, that's what the term we use when they're giving out the instructions that they contain. Easy way to understand that is that in every cell, except for blood cells, there's a few exceptions, you know, we have the full blueprints, we'll say, for our entire physiology and structure of our bodies. But obviously, not every cell is exactly the same. So like in the liver, only the liver genes are turned on. In the kidney, only the kidney genes are turned on. And so you can see how there's very specific ways that we have certain cells where certain genes are turned on and certain genes are turned off. So if we look at how our genes express or don't express, what we find, it's fairly complex. So we have certain situations where people are born with what we call genetic mutations, meaning that how the gene is supposed to be structured, it's not structured like that. So it's not going to give the right information, or it could be that it's not giving any information at all. Then we have, which is more often the case, is that we used to think that our DNA was a completely static molecule, that it didn't change at all. But what we have found now is that it changes all the time. And everything that we do, from the foods we eat, the supplements we take, even the thoughts that we think, will produce chemicals that will hook onto our DNA, and they will turn certain genes on and turn certain genes off. So there's a whole new realm of medicine called epigenetics. So epi meaning kind of on the top, but these are all the things that can come and influence how your genes express. So ultimately, it most